the day so far?
Today, tomorrow, yesterday, it's all the same. You?
This is the Extra Hawk Rate Podcast, episode 311 for the week of July 13th, 2020. I am Nice Legs, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Bad Reception Wine, Sarah D. Bunting.
Hashtag Cupcake Shardo Goals, am I right?
Unprepared Wedding Speaker, Tara Ariano.
Oh no, I had so much of the Bad Reception Wine.
And Desert Dinosaur, Alana Bennett.
Making their way downtown.
Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Joining us for the very first time, straight out of Roswell, New Mexico. Not really, she's from Los Angeles, but she is a writer on Roswell, New Mexico. It's Alana Bennett. Hello, Alana.
Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Yay! Welcome to the show. So we're here to talk about Palm Springs. And now, much as we Canadians claim anyone who lived in Canada for any part of their life, I'm going to say we TV critics are claiming any piece of content that premiered on a streaming service, which is why we are talking about a movie.
Gotcha.
The
longer coronavirus goes on, the more of these shows we're going to get. We just have to face reality. As TV dwindles, so rises streaming movies.
Exactly. We'll be here talking about a Bandersnatch before long. But anyway, that includes Palm Springs, which was originally intended to be a theatrical release. It was a big hit at Sundance, but is now coming to the world simultaneously at drive-ins, at places where there are drive-ins, and on Hulu for obvious reasons. Obviously, you know, a lot of traditional movie theaters are not open. So the premise, and I will keep it broad for the intro for people who haven't seen it yet. Niles, who's played by Andy Samberg, is at a wedding in Palm Springs with his girlfriend Misty, who is Meredith Hagner from Search Party. She's a bridesmaid in this wedding. He does not seem to be having a very good time, but he does seem able to predict the rhythms of everyone's movements at the reception with eerie accuracy. Also not having a good time, the bride's older sister, maid of honor Sarah, who's played by Kristen Milioti from How I Met Your Mother. But Niles is able to pull her away from the reception to goof around. And they end up in the desert making out, which is when things start to get weird. And the movie, I think, is more fun if you don't know anything about it going in. So that's where I'm going to pause and say, obviously, this discussion is about the movie in its entirety. There will therefore be spoilers about the whole thing, including the end. So if you haven't watched it, maybe fast forward to Around the Dial and come back and listen to this segment after you have watched the movie. So, Alana, you chose this topic this week from a menu of options. What made you want to talk about this more than, let's say, Greyhound, the World War II naval epic starring Tom Hanks? And do you regret your choice?
Also hilarious.
Listen, I will always love and respect Tom Hanks, but it felt like time for an Andy Samberg joint, you know?
Yeah.
It's just that was the vibe.
It's summer.
Summer.
Were you pleased with it, with the choice? Did it live up to your hopes?
It did. It feels like this has been a really nice weekend for quarantine movies that remind you of, I don't know, some of the themes in the movie do resonate differently when you are just living in your home day to day.
Yeah.
And also just like, it's nice and it's romantic and it's, love in a hopeless place type of thing, which feels very good for the time. And also everyone's just so charming.
Yeah, I agree.
We've been doing this COVID routine for so long. It's just the way it is now that never occurred to me that we're just basically living the same day over and over again in our own house, never really leaving. So it's our own personal Palm Springs.
Yeah.
Somehow that didn't occur to me until right now, until Lana said it.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, so now that the spoiler phobes have left, presumably, we can say what the real premise of the movie is, which is Niles is in a time loop. He has lived the day of this wedding more times than he can remember. And when he takes Sarah to the desert, he gets shot by an archer named Roy, who's played by J.K. Simmons. He knows him, seems unsurprised to see that this guy is hunting him, and he crawls into a nearby cave, and Sarah starts to follow Niles, and he yells at her not to, but when the day resets, he finds out she did follow him. Now, she's also in the time loop with him as well. and with Roy as two, but Roy's not there all the time. We'll come back to Roy. And so I did think that it was cute that as in a zombie movie where no one says the word zombie, no one says like, oh, we're in a Groundhog Day.
Right.
It's the same right. kind of thing. But I did like how the opening scenes show Niles in a time loop, in time loop res. So it takes a little bit before you figure out he's not just disaffected in a normal way. And that, you know, he's not in this day for the fact that he's not in this day for the first time takes a little while to reveal itself. So, Alana, given that we're all familiar with the Groundhog Day storytelling format, how do you think that the filmmakers did making it fresh?
I think they did really well because I did not know much about the concept going in.
Excellent.
I didn't even remember necessarily that there was like that kind of fantasy supernatural twist on it. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, I wonder what Andy Samberg's going to be up to today. And I guess he's disaffected. Oh, and I guess he's kind of kooky.
Yeah.
And then I rewatched the beginning this morning and was like, oh. Like, all of this really does tie together really well.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what did you think? How much did you know about it going in, and did you like it?
I loved it. I knew nothing about it. I was like, are there going to be songs? Will there be baseball again? Like, I don't tend to watch Lonely Planet material unless you, T-Bone, make me, mm-hmm. or this podcast makes me. And mm-hmm. then I'm always like, why don't I watch everything they do? The fact is that you've made me watch enough of it that I think I'm caught up. But having recently celebrated a wedding anniversary, the itchy one, 7 years, yay me and Dan. But like there were certain lines in this and situations and philosophical discussions about like marriage sometimes coming down to who you can stand to be stuck mm-hmm. with for long periods of time.
Yeah.
Maybe this is just where my practical head is at. I chose quite well in that regard, but not everyone has been so lucky in their circumstances. So this definitely was very resonant for me in the I think it's Heather Havrilesky who's like, actually, romance is people seeing you at your worst and just sort of soldiering on. Mm-hmm. So that aspect of the romance resonated with me. But like someone giving someone else a tattoo, American Vandal dick tattoo. She's like, are the balls hairless like I wanted? I mean, and Milioti is so charming. I hope she finally breaks through to become a massive star because she was perfect in this. Everyone was great. I feel like the math held up. I thought it was really enjoyable. Perfect length too.
She feels like she might inherit the Linda Cardellini curse, which is like always on the precipice of breaking out.
I hope
not. Yeah.
But never quite, but deserved of it.
Yeah. You know? We all know you have a black heart, Dave. What did you think of this movie?
I feel like J.K. Simmons is having like the decade of his life right now, that
yeah.
he's picking
yeah.
exactly the projects yes. that he wants to do. And nobody is telling him, like he doesn't have the manager whispering in his ear anymore. He's just he's reading it. That would be fun. So he does it. He's yeah. this weird time traveling archer guy who's bent on revenge. Sure. Why not? Let's do it.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about way back when on this podcast way back in Mark One, where we had a couple episodes called The Unhateables,
mm-hmm.
which is that group of celebrity that has graduated to the point where it's really, really hard for anybody to hate them. Like Donald Glover was one of them, The mm-hmm. Rock.
Yeah.
And I feel like J.K. Simmons, enough time has passed since Oz that the few people that might
right.
hate him for Oz
sure.
have, you know, passed away, have forgotten,
right.
whatever. That I think we can put J.K. Simmons in the unhateable group.
I'd agree with that.
I agree, and here is why. Even commercials that you love when you watch live sports back in the before time when those existed, you ended up seeing, as a Mets fan, the same 7 or 8 ads over and over again. Cars for Kids has recast, still irredeemable, but the We Are Farmers ads with J.K. Simmons, like it's kind of hacky. It's kind of tired at this point. I would cross the street to kick Flo in the shins. J.K. Simmons, still unhateable.
Yeah.
Happy that he's getting that paycheck. So that's how unhateable he is. You're right, Dave.
I think of J.K. Simmons as kind of like male Alice and Janney.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. That's a great analogy.
That's awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just like every time that they show up, I'm just happy. And it feels like they couldn't be played by anybody else, even though technically they could, but you don't want anything but that specific energy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah, when he went to the bar and ordered your drink, Sarah, I thought, oh, that's one just for Bunsy.
That is in my notes. So I was like, okay, Bunt Nip, I'm in, fine.
So we find out what happened with the story with Roy and why he's hunting Niles is that they had one night where they just partied, and then like just on a lark, they were super high, and Niles ill-advisedly was like, I guess Roy said something like, I don't ever want this night to end. And Niles was like, well, and then brought him into the cave. And now Roy is, you know, obviously not happy that Niles knew what he was doing, kind of. I mean, he was out of his mind, obviously, on drugs. And so, but because Roy wakes up every day in Irvine, they establish he's not there every day. He just comes back every few weeks to like fuck with Niles in various ways and torture him. And so that's why he doesn't come back all the time, and Niles never knows when he's coming. But at the end, it's Sarah eventually decides she doesn't want to keep living this day, and we'll get back to her in a second too. But she basically teaches herself physics and figures out how to solve this.
To the tune of Genesis, the Brazilian from the Invisible Touch album, the best song on the album.
Okay.
We'll do a different podcast about that.
Speaking of people
P.S. If anyone watched through to the credits, there was like a big graph of thanks to various physicists around the world.
That's awesome.
That's so wholesome. I don't know.
There's a point where we see her on the phone leaving a message, and then in the credits, Roy comes back and he like taps Niles on the shoulder.
Out of the loop now.
He's like, hey, I got your girlfriend's message. What are we doing? And Niles has no idea who he is. And Roy is like, oh, great. So earlier in the movie, Niles goes to Irvine, and Roy has like had an epiphany through various, you know, plot events, and is like, this was always a good day. I've made peace with my lot in life. Yeah, I'm never going to see my kids grow up, but like, this is not so bad. But how do we feel about where the movie left Roy? Because, like, it's one thing to just figure that there's no way out and this is the best that it's going to get. But then Roy finds out there is a way out and he missed it. And that's, I mean, the closing credits sort of leave it like, well, good for them, I guess, back to my existence.
Oh, I presume that she gave him the shorthand of what she did so that he will go through the same process and figure it out.
Oh.
Yeah, that was my assumption, too, is that he was finally free and could finally see his children grow up, which was so sad.
Because like there was an actual name for what it was, the something-something tunnel or something like that. So that would be the starting point for his research, and he would go through that same education and then figure it out.
Okay.
I think is where they were leading you.
Okay.
Yeah, or just like that she told him, like, this specific time, blow yourself up and you'll land somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, okay. All right, I like that better.
I do wish we'd seen the goat again.
Yeah, where did he go?
Yeah. All right, so back to Sarah. And considering how much of the movie has to be, you know, the same day with tiny variations and then, you know, a lot of pure silliness as Niles and Sarah get to know each other, what is held back is the reveal about where and how Sarah wakes up every morning, which is she had slept with the groom the night before. And every day when she wakes up in this day, she's in his room and he's there telling her that she should probably get out.
And the groom is in relation to her.
The groom is her sister's. Yes. Well, I already said she's the bride's sister.
Sorry.
So because there's definitely a big part of me that is Niles-y, where it's like, life is on hold, you're staying in a beautiful place, you have no immediate responsibilities, it's a day you're supposed to relax, you're not in the wedding, this is not a bad day to relive eternally. That's not the case for her, and I think the way the movie established that and held back that reveal of like why this would be a particular kind of torture for her, I thought was well done. What did you guys think of that? Anyone can go first.
Well, I like that. Unlike Groundhog Day, and this was a little bit earlier, that they nailed that self-improvement was not necessarily the key to unlocking the day, right? Like that was...
That's her first guess.
Right. And, you know, that didn't happen. So ultimately, they're much the same person when they get out of it than they were in it. Like, on a base level. Like, they've had experiences with each other and other people and have made the decisions in life, but I don't think they're fundamentally changed people, which is nice, kind of. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like enter schlub and dick and then exit model citizens.
That right.
Didn't really happen, yeah. And I appreciate that. So that was refreshing, and I think that's sort of part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was nice to see them kind of layer in, like, over time, like, when she thinks that the way out is, like, a morality clause, basically, mm-hmm. and she tries to tell her sister the truth, like, that doesn't, like, it's not going to save you. And I like that kind of as a theme of, like, maybe you just have to find someone to understand you and also help understand yourself, and it's not gonna, releasing yourself of that guilt by telling somebody else the shitty thing you did isn't necessarily gonna release you from the shitty thing.
Right.
It's just you're still caught in your own loop.
Yeah.
No. I mean, ultimately, when you talk about the realities of the universe they're in, it was a scientific problem. So they didn't mm-hmm. have to go through any personal growth, right?
Yes, but, exactly. Right.
So they solve it. It's solved scientifically, and there is character growth, but it is not that, like, it's not like
no.
the fortune-telling machine that made it happen, or, no. you know, the magical groundhog or whatever it yes. was. Like, there's actually a thing there that doesn't mean they have to become different people in order to get themselves out of it. That's what I meant.
Right. What were you going to say, yeah. Sarah?
I was just going to ask how everyone felt about the backstory for each of them outside the loop. Because I found myself both wanting to know more. Like, at one point she's like, what was your job? And he's like, I can't remember. And I think we never find out.
No.
And then it only comes up at the end when they're floating in the pool that he's like, oh yeah, I should go get my dog. She's like, you have a dog? I did feel, as a dog owner, like that would have come up in like day three.
Seriously.
I'm just like super into my pets anyway. Mm-hmm. In a way that is perhaps not realistic. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know more about them outside, but I also respected the story for being like, you don't need that. And this isn't like mm-hmm. Lost, where we have to keep doing flashbacks to whatever, Kate being cuffed to a marshal on the plane. Like, we can tell you what you need to know and no more. So I wondered what everyone else thought of that. Did you think it was frustrating or tantalizing?
I kind of liked that they kept, like, a logic question that I did have is, like, if Andy Samberg has been living the same day for, as it seems like, years in his brain time, then, like, why has he only been spending it, presumably, in the general Palm Springs area? Why not, like, try to get as far as you can, like, away, or, like, hang out elsewhere, you know, some of the time? And they really do keep it very much, very, like, isolated to that space, which I think kind of does help the story itself, even though logically I am still like, it feels like the Voldemort only hides the Horcruxes in the UK type of thing. Like, you can branch out a little bit.
Well, didn't he tell a story about getting, like, trying to last the longest without falling asleep, and yes. he made it to South America?
He said
or
he
something?
Got to oh, Equatorial yeah,
yeah.
Guinea.
Yeah. And yeah. then, like, it was, like, futile to do it because he couldn't escape by yeah. just trying to escape.
Right.
Yeah. yeah. But even if he lived in LA, like, you could just go hang out with your dog for the day or something yeah. like that. And they never really, like, maybe he did that in his, like, the time that we don't see. But I kind of like that in the time that we do see, it is kind of in the same general area, especially when Christian Milioti joins the game. Mm-hmm. I feel like that kind of helps the claustrophobia of the narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also a smart way to reveal the story of, like, having him explain the rules of the situation to her when she comes into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought that was elegant.
Can we talk about the first scene that made me and Tara mad, but then we realized it was actually a good scene, which is the morning cell phone at 17% charged? Who does that? And you realize, well, what a great shorthand for a character that they left their phone uncharged overnight
because she's not in her room.
I didn't even notice that, and you're so right.
Yeah. One critique I saw on Twitter this weekend that I thought was valid was that for a movie that's called Palm Springs, it really doesn't have much of a sense of place.
They didn't shoot it there.
Well, I mean, that would explain it, but even so, like, you know, other than that they're near a desert, like, it doesn't feel like it's anywhere. Like, it could be I think one of the tweets was like, call it Flagstaff. Like, it could just as easily be there.
Yeah, seriously, Sedona.
Yeah, like, you know, Palm Springs is like such a distinct place. Like, where are all the old retired gay guys? Come on, guys. Seriously. So,
it was probably one tax credit away from being whatever. Anyways, they were probably leaving open. Like, it could have been, you know, like, well, it's Albuquerque, just like Breaking Bad now because you got tax credit. Or it's Riverside, you know, or whatever.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. If we're going to leave the topic soon, I have to ask as dumb guy because I just didn't get it.
Okay.
The dinosaurs?
Yeah.
What?
They were on mushrooms.
Oh. Yeah, they were just on drugs.
I missed that.
when he said these are really good mushrooms, did you think they were like just eating mushrooms? Oh, maybe. Dave.
Oh,
square Dave. So I just had one last thing, which was this movie makes the case that love is reliving the same day over and over with someone you're already sick of. As Sarah already touched on this, I don't necessarily think that's not true.
Gently put.
We are creatures of habit. So it is just sort of a forced extension of that existence, is it not? Mm-hmm. It's just like we had a life in February of 2020 that was this open, mm-hmm. and it closed halfway to what we have now. And Palm Springs is just like the next exponential shrinking of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, on a spectrum, it's kind of the same thing, just more of.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I'm cool with it.
Okay.
Well, as he says that after that comment, it's the best. So it really depends on where in your sort of spectrum of tolerances, I guess, that being sick of each other lies. Because if you're already at that point, but you're okay with it, I guess that is the best for him and for a lot of people. So,
Alana will give you the last word.
Oh, on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of, I think it was a Bill Murray quote or something, but years ago, I saw this quote that was like, never marry somebody you wouldn't like want to travel around the world and fight with while you're like on a 12-hour flight, you know, while you're trekking around the world. And that's when, that one's like, while you're on this big adventure that's going to be stressful to you, like, you want to be with somebody who you know that you can survive that with. And I think that this is the same thing, even though it's the more boring version. It's like, you do have to be like, never marry somebody, as many people have learned this year, never marry somebody you don't want to be quarantined with or being stuck in a groundhog day loop with.
Yeah.
And this is very much that.
It's good advice.
Amen.
It's time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
I wanted to talk about Little Voice, which is the new half-hour dramedy on Apple TV+. Half-hour dramedy. Love to see it. The premise of the show is that we have a girl named Bess, who's played by Brittany O'Grady, most recently of that show Star, which was on Fox for a hot minute, the girl group show from Lee Daniels. It was the show that was not Empire, the other one. Right. Queen Latifah was also on. It's established in the first episode. She has a million gigs. She's a dog walker. She plays music at an old folks home. She teaches music lessons. She works in a bar, but she's also trying to be a songwriter and a singer. She also has a storage unit that she is tricked out to be like her studio. So even though it's established, like, she's kind of broke, she can afford to do this, which, all right. Like, I'm not necessarily here for like strict economic realism, but she lives in New York, so like, I doubt it, but fine. And next to her storage unit is a filmmaker who has done the same thing with his, and his name is Ethan. He's played by Sean Teal, and he's British and he's very cute. And she's, you know, drawn to him immediately. They have a very meet cute night where they play Scrabble and eat snacks and get to know each other. And he comes to her bar job. And so she's, even though she's gun shy after a bad experience at an open mic, she tries to go up on stage so that she can impress him. But it doesn't go well. And then when she gets off stage, she finds out he has a girlfriend. Whoops, that's even worse. But it does spark her desire to get her songwriting career going again. So series was created by Sarah Bareilles and Jesse Nelson, who worked together previously on the Broadway show Waitress. Also in the cast are Sakina Joffrey from a million shows. She plays the mother of Bess's roommate. Chuck Cooper, who is a Tony winner. Kevin Valdez is a newcomer, and he plays Bess's brother, who is on the autism spectrum and has just moved into supportive housing. So they get a lot of stuff, I think, right about her relationship with him, that she's really trying to help him be independent, but also like never ever misses any of his phone calls. And there's issues with her dad as well, that his career as a singer never kind of got off the ground because of addiction issues that are revealed over the course of the season. And something else happens over the course of the season that helps flesh out all of the family's backstories, which I won't spoil. Bess doesn't always get things right, and the show lets her live with her fuck-ups instead of treating her like its perfect saintly center, which I think is often the problem with shows like this. But the love triangle is what really evokes the Felicity vibes the most. Also that J.J. Abrams is an executive producer on it. Alana had tweeted a couple of weeks ago that she was looking for a new show with a lot of good yearning. And so I was like, maybe three or four episodes into this one, I was like, I found it. Like, there's a lot of scenes when someone is singing, totally oblivious that another character is just gazing at them in complete adoration. So, you know, it's sweet. There's a love triangle too with another person that Bess plays with, but it's good. I would say, in terms of the Apple shows that have come out over the past year, it's hard to say it's better than Dickinson, because that is, you know, its own animal so much. But, and, you know, it's impossible to compare anything else to it. But ditto the morning show, which is its own kind of delicious, scandalous, empty calories. But I would say Little Voice is definitely the best Apple TV Plus show of 2020. And you should especially watch it if you liked Felicity, Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay.
Alana, did you get to it this weekend?
I did not, but it is top of my list.
Okay, good. For my plugs, I wrote about Little Voice in my debut for Collider.com, so we will link to that in the show notes. And I also want to plug Absent Friends. Our former Previously.tv contributor, Pilot Virouette, recently had a post on TVGuide.com about how TV is finally getting away from reflexively only portraying tragic stories about queer life and instead is starting to show queer joy. So we'll link that in the show notes as well. I reached out to Pilot to see if they would want to come on the podcast. Sadly, Pilot let me know they're more comfortable consuming podcasts rather than guesting on them. So I want to plug the other project that they've been working on this summer, and which I think they would plug if they were here, which is The People's Bodega in New York. You may have seen it written up in Vogue last month. They go to protests, marches, other justice actions, and provide protesters with masks, hand sanitizer, drinks, snacks, sunscreen, all for free.
I have seen them. They were at the one I went to, and the snacks were pretty good.
Oh, like,
impressively awesome. Good snacks.
Yeah, I've seen pictures. They look legit. Vogue described it as a mobile mutual aid site. So if you're in New York and can donate groceries or other materials that we'll keep, I think you can follow them on Instagram at The People's Bodega NYC, all one word, obviously, and we'll link that too, but to find out how you can donate directly. But if you're not, and if you can afford to donate money, they also have a PayPal. So we'll link that in the show notes too, The People's Bodega. They also have an outlet in LA as well. So good work from them.
Alana, what do you have?
Recently, I have been watching the 1985 Anne of Green Gables, so I'm kind of in throwback mode.
Canadian content.
Yeah.
Content. Yeah. Because I had been I feel like saying this will activate like 80,000 Twitter fans, but I was a fan of Anne with an E. Mm-hmm. I had some critiques, but I also had a lot of things that I like really liked about what they were doing, and I had not known much about Anne of Green Gables before then. I just knew that it was something that lots of people love from their childhood. So I ate up Anne with an E throughout all of the, I believe, three seasons.
Yeah.
The most recent thing that I'm writing is like very loosely inspired by those types of vibes. So I was like, I really want to see like what it is that everybody loves so much about the original. And plus I put one of my early quarantine binges was a rewatch of Rain. And I just, reliving the glory of Megan Follows as like the evil queen, or the sometimes evil, sometimes like wonderful queen. And she's just so juicy and delicious in that show, and she's so amazing in the original Anne as well, is what I learned when I finally sat down and watched it. It was kind of disorienting to watch because the story of Anne Shirley gets stretched over, like, very slowly over three seasons of Anne with an E in some great ways. And so I was not expecting necessarily, like, how quickly it moves in miniseries form, where, like, suddenly you're, like, going through years and you're going, and especially with the yearning with her and Gilbert, which I have come to appreciate as a classic yearning romance of yore.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just all the drama with her and her adopted parents. Spoiler alert, there's a death that does not happen in Anne with an E that really took me by surprise. But it's been a nice adventure. I feel like I finally understand a little bit more about Canadians.
I've watched that so many times.
Hold on. Hang on. What did Anne of Green Gables teach you about Canadians exactly?
A lot of people in my mentions have been talking about Anne of Green Gables.
Oh, okay. Well,
people,
yeah.
That people love the
people
book.
Who sure. love, yeah, that just that they love Anne of Green Gables, that some yeah. of them love Anne of Green Gables.
Yeah, I watched that miniseries. My grandparents had a VCR like before any of like my mother and any of her siblings did, and they taped that off TV when it was on CBC in 1985. And so we probably wore out that tape. I've watched it so many times.
It's just like I feel like I missed out, and especially like so many of my friends were like when I told them I was watching this were like. Gilbert Blythe was formative for them.
For sure.
So I feel like I missed out on it. I feel like I missed out on this like little baby teen heartthrob.
Yeah, that actor died really young too.
He died?
Yeah,
oh
he's
no.
Dead.
Oh no.
No. Oh God. Well, I still have some of the adult movies to watch.
Yes.
So I've still got to do.
Do you know how, like, David Hasselhoff, the thing everybody says, well, he had a big music career in Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, or he's big in Germany. You're like, okay, maybe 20 years ago he had a couple hits and he was hot for 6 months. You don't really think that he's still big in Germany. And then for Anne of Green Gables, the equivalent is the Japanese love
They're
Anne of Green Gables. They're crazy
it.
For
they
it.
Do?
It's all they-
yeah.
And I thought, we've been hearing this since... the 80s, like,
yeah.
since it came out. It's like a big thing. Like they have like theme cafes
they
or
have
something
like cons
like that.
And
yeah.
stuff.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, again, that was a couple years, you know, it was a fad. The last road trip I took with my dad, we drove to PEI. He bought potatoes from PEI. This was like a 3-day trip. And then we headed back. It was just like a stupid thing that was the destination. So while we're in Charlottetown, which is the capital of Prince Edward Island, and the general area, all these Japanese tourist group everywhere. I'm like, holy shit,
oh
that thing was 25 years ago or
yeah.
whatever. And it's still happening. Japanese tourists still coming over for their Anne of Green Gables fill. So next time somebody says Hasselhoff is still big in Germany, I'm like, well, possibly.
I get it now. Yeah. I feel like I've glimpsed an important part of history now.
And presumably you will want to plug your show, Roswell, New Mexico.
Yes, both seasons are on Netflix. I only wrote for the second season, but the first season's good, too. Lots of yearning in that. Lots of horny aliens.
The best kind.
Have you been to Roswell? Did they send you to Roswell as part of your... No?
No.
Oh, man.
No, we film in Santa Fe, so I have been... mainly around there.
You got to do some field research because Roswell is crazy and stupid and fun.
It is fun.
It's like a tiny little Las Vegas, but instead of slot machines, everything has alien heads on it. Like
yep.
even the McDonald's and stuff. It's
and
funny.
Yeah,
it's
interesting. Streetlights and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do that through like so much more of New Mexico than I thought, like all through the Santa Fe airport. One of the places we don't film, although we should, but where we eat lunch sometimes is this like roller rink full of like Roswell-y like alien tchotchkes that like, and sometimes like at lunch they're like these elderly women who dress up as aliens and roller skate around us.
Wow.
It's a sight to behold.
Amazing.
It's just like throughout the entire
new
state,
retirement
I guess.
Plan.
Exactly.
Sarah D. Bunting.
All right. Well, in keeping, I guess, sort of with the yearning leitmotif, my husband and I have undertaken a Cheers rewatch from the beginning. I taught this pilot in a class as like, one of the best pilots ever. It
holds up, even though I've like seen it and been over it with a fine tooth comb. So we're like midway through season one. Our esteemed colleague, John Ramos, has a side bet with himself that I'm going to get a little ways into the Rebecca era and give up, but that's a while away. So, we're enjoying it so far, but it's like, it's really mind-boggling that this premiered in 1982. Like, that's it's really a long time ago. And certainly the wardrobe is like, the wardrobe is sort of fascinating to me. And then to both of us, we're fascinated by like locating it in time based on the sports references, which I forgot how sportsy, like whatever, it's a bar in Boston. Like, of course it's sportsy, but like they're watching some Red Sox game and Carl Yastrzemski is up and dance like he was still alive. I'm like, I mean, I think he's still alive now, but yes, I believe he was still playing at that time. And just looking at all the stuff that's hung up on the walls and how much things cost. And like someone gets a beer for $1 and we laughed and laughed. And it's interesting to see the way they treat Sam not drinking and sort of his relationship with that and how he dealt with that. And but yeah, I mean, it's still a really good show. And Shelley Long is, I think, an underrated comedic force still, even though I would say she is vastly preferred to Rebecca as these things go. But she's really amazing and really game. And related for my plug, Quaid in Full, the podcast in which Jeb Lund and I watch every single televisual Dennis Quaid property in chronological order, has arrived. One of the worst movies ever made, Caveman, the Ringo Starr vehicle, so to speak. Dixon from Alias is also in it. Like, randomly, a lot of people that you know are in it, including Shelley Long, who's like kind of the only good thing about it. Like, the movie wrote its own whole caveman language, and Dennis Quaid still can't tame the Texas accent. His caveman dialogue that he's like, go org, and you're like, oh honey, what are you doing? Anyway, that is next up on the Quaid in Full podcast, which you can find wherever you download podcasts. And if you want to rewatch Cheers along with us and try to hook up a watch party, we're here for it.
A couple things. One, didn't we just see Dixon in something too? Buckaroo Banzai was he in?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then going back to Cheers, one of the things when we rewatched Cheers last year, was how interesting it is for the character of Cliff Clavin to watch him today, now that we have a name to put to his character type, you know, like incel. And you see that he ticks off every fucking box.
Yeah.
And how much creepier it is now, partly because you have real world people that you have seen on the internet to compare that to and know that it is more than a flight of fancy, which you might have thought back then. Like, of course, yeah, there's losers in love and he has so many analogs to what we call an incel now that is so fucking creepy, that part of it.
Well, and he's still, like, early on, he's not even in the main credits.
Yeah.
He's not sitting in his normal spot at the bar. He's just talking about how the average whale's intestines are 3 miles long. And you're like, well, he's harmless enough. It's probably a spectrum thing. But so we have that to look forward to,
yeah,
I guess. Yay.
All right, I want to talk about the new animated show Close Enough from the creator of Regular Show. It just debuted on HBO Max. I think all the episodes that we watched are up.
Yeah.
It's like the entire season.
The whole season, yep.
So I was sort of hoping coming into it that it would be charged with that same Regular Show weirdness, but I knew that Close Enough was a story about millennial parents, so I didn't really have my hopes up. And as the first episode opens, it really seemed rather pedestrian. Like, the problems presented were, you know, their toddler at preschool or wherever she is having troubles, and they're talking to their Zen never say no teacher, and it was like, okay, I've seen this all before. Is this really what the regular show guy is doing? Mm-hmm. And then it takes a left turn at Albuquerque. It gets fucking weird. I'm like, all right, this is a show I came for. Like, in that same episode, they stumble across a group of English street urchins who trade their sweatshop skills to make a quilt in exchange for a couple hours of good old parenting because they miss it so much. And that's like one of the tamer things that happens on the show. Like, there's a whole episode later that borrows wholesale from Logan's Run. It's about a bar where people over 30 are killed, like Carousel.
Wow.
Kids ask your grandparents. It's fun like regular show. It has a lot of the same stupid inclinations as regular show, but it's also, because it's about this family, it's also more grounded, and it kind of works. Like, that balance works for it, I think, where it seems a lot less like a stoner Adult Swim show now than it does like something where you could pull in the Bob's Burger people into this more elastic reality and get away with it and still capture that regular show audience. Most of the episodes, so they show them in pairs, so there's 2 11-minute episodes per chunk, you know, per stream, and the last one is a 22-minute episode. And I feel like the show could probably graduate to a full half-hour show, and it would probably do better for the fortunes of the show, I think.
Yeah.
Like, this show feels like it's very Bob's Burgers adjacent as far as audience and opportunity go.
Yeah, but this is another one, like we were saying about Search Party and 2 weeks ago when I was talking about it, where like this was made years ago.
Yeah.
And it's been sitting around.
It was supposed to be on TBS.
It was supposed to be on TBS. Yeah. And then it was like orphaned for reasons.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So it's a funny show. The part that made me just laugh out loud, and it's mostly, I think, because I just never heard this term before, but there's an episode called Skate Dad, and the sort of family sitcom premise is that he wants to show, you know, he used to be a skateboarder back in the day and he wants to show his daughter how to skate. But really he's out of tune and the daughter is really interested in getting lessons from this young teenage skater at the skate shop. And he's just having confidence issues for the whole thing. So he's going to go to the skate park and really show her. And he totally
instantly wipes out and hurts himself really bad.
So that's what you're going to hear. And there's a term here, which is actually a term in skateboarding, which I found out later in research that just made me laugh out loud.
Watch and learn.
So at this point, the skateboard lands on the ground straight up and he lands right on his junk on the end of the skateboard sticking straight up. So now continuing.
Knife.
I'm fine. I'm not done shredding yet.
Daddy, what's an ass knife?
That's a different lesson.
Hey, Josh. Can't believe they put a metal plate on your taint.
Skate Dad is skate sad.
Close enough. Highly recommended. It is pretty funny. The other thing I want to talk about streaming is the thing I got a press release for. My eyes have never rolled quicker or further back than the Hulu press release for the HaHa Awards.
Yeah,
the hilarious animated Hulu Awards, aka the HaHa Awards, celebrating excellence in the animated world with a high percentage somehow of Hulu shows making the cut, such as the Crossing Swords or whatever that show is that talking about and the stuff like that that nobody's watched, but somehow is up for half the categories.
Right.
Super cringy. And just like, you know, the name of it, you know, the acronym for it is really bad. Instantly, I went on Instagram. I was trying to figure out like other awards they can do. And the one I came up with was the Put Aside the Happiness of Streaming or Pathos Awards for their drama awards.
Sure.
So, you know, they can do stuff like that. So I think from now on in the podcast, I'm going to value comedies by asking the question, it's funny, but is it hilarious animated Hulu Awards funny? And I think that's the new benchmark for these kind of things. So,
boo.
Hey, look, I'm just boo. Passing the flavor on up the chain.
Okay.
So my new podcast is up. It is the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. If you enjoy game time on this podcast, I think you will find lots of things to love on that. It first episode is up. You can visit our site, usaquizshow.com, where you could subscribe and find out more about the podcast. Our first episode is our pilot special. It features Will Leach, Jessica Morgan, and Jeb Lund, all names that should be familiar to people that listen to this podcast. They navigate about 40 minutes of pop culture trivia, including the games Did You Hear About the Morgans and Apocalypse Chow is our marquee games for the first episode. That is available right now. It is already out. The first competitive season starts next week. Listeners are the contestants during the regular season. So if you all ever wanted to play Game Time, this is sort of your chance. We're taking names for season two already. So get on to usaquizshow.com, subscribe, and we'll see you over there. Dan Cassino, Taylor Cole are my cohorts. A lot of fun. Next on Extra, Extra Hot Great, it's Putting the Cock in Peacock.
Yep.
Gritty reboots of NBC properties a la The Good Fight. Taking something, adding some swears, maybe some boobs.
Peacockinizing it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That is available to all supporters at any level at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. And on the next EHG Prime, it is the CW's British Import Killer Camp with guest Kate Sanchez of the But Why Though podcast and online magazine. So look forward to that next week. It's time for the canon. Presenting this week is Jenny. Take it away, Jenny.
Should it please the extra hot great court, I've come before your honorable tribunal to argue on behalf of one of the greatest episodes of the last great network drama. Season 5, Episode 5 of The Good Wife, Hitting the Fan. When The Good Wife premiered in 2009, a CBS legal procedural with a ripped from the Elliot Spitzer headlines premise didn't sound like a show that could end up in the prestige television conversation. But Alicia Florrick turned out to be a spiritual sister to the middle-aged white male antiheroes of the most recent golden age of television. By the time the show reached this episode, she had shed her St. Alicia wronged woman origins. She embarked on an affair with her law school classmate turned law partner boss Will Gardner that towed the line of network standards with its sexiness and showed herself to possess a remarkably pragmatic approach to the law, her career, and her politically convenient marriage. At the end of the fourth season, she decided to join fellow Lockhart Gardner associate Carrie Agos in launching their own firm, which makes its debut in this episode. Allow me to present the following evidence of Hitting the Fan's canon worthiness. Exhibit A. The episode pays off seasons of relationship building and character development. Hitting the Fan opens with Diane Lockhart telling Will what she realized at the end of the previous episode. Alicia and Carrie are starting a new firm and taking major clients with them. It takes Will a solid beat to process this information before he goes to Alicia and confirms her departure, as we hear in the admittedly lengthy clip one.
It's time I try something new.
I took you in. No one wanted you. I hired you. I pushed for you.
Will, this is a business decision.
You were poison! This firm got you back on your feet.
And I will always be thankful.
And this is how you show it? By stealing our clients?
We didn't steal anything. These were clients.
You have a fiduciary responsibility to this firm, and you were going behind our backs.
I didn't go behind any backs.
You negotiated Diane's exit package.
You asked
me to. And the whole time you knew you were leaving.
Nothing I was doing impacted that negotiation.
You're awful. And you don't even know how awful you are.
This is how you and Diane started this
firm.
Don't
you dare compare. Okay. Okay. First of all, you're fired. Second, I'm taking this company's cell phone until such
time
as
I... Excuse me. That's my personal...
And I'm taking it into possession until I can determine which clients you've attempted to steal.
You can't do that.
Get out of here, Alicia. Right now. You're fired.
Will's righteous fury kicks off 40-plus minutes of years of interpersonal drama between the Lockhart-Gardner lawyers and associated players coming to a head. Carrie unleashes the resentment he's been harboring since Diane and Will chose to hire Alicia over him at the end of the first season, and tips off Diane to the clients and associates they're poaching in the process. Kalinda plays Carrie and the audience, ultimately pledging allegiance to Lockhart Gardner after faking out her former friend with benefits in a ploy for information. Peter Florek and Will have it out, no longer muzzled by any need to fake niceties for Alicia's benefit. 90 episodes worth of emotional history informs every action, including the legal maneuvering, as seen in Exhibit B. Hitting the Fan plays with expectations by having the main characters argue against each other in court. This episode lacks the repertory of recurring opposing counsel that was a hallmark of the Good Wife universe. Instead, the schism between the firms forces our main characters to face off for access to everyone's favorite Google analog with a beaver mascot, Chum Hum. This tweak to the procedural formula complicates audience sympathies. The framework of the show set us up to root for Alicia, but now that success comes at the expense of characters we're also invested in. Both teams earn small victories throughout the episode, but Florek Agos ultimately wins the $35 million account, keeping the new firm alive and this destabilization of the audience's vested interest in play. Less in play is Alicia's home life, which brings me to Exhibit C. This episode features the perfect amount of Alicia's kids, which is to say, very little. Motherhood is a facet of Alicia's life, but not necessarily the most interesting thing about her. And this episode wisely uses her children in service to a storyline about her career. Hitting the Fan pulls them into the story just enough, with Alicia turning to Zach for tech help in rescuing client files from the cloud before she loses access, and Grace fretting about a lost permission slip with Will and getting perhaps a bit too friendly over scripture apps with the other Carrie. The kids are around, but they're not drawing time or attention from the corporate mutiny at hand, and neither is Alicia's husband, which is my Exhibit D. The political B-plot also serves Alicia's story. The episode justifies Peter's continued existence on the show by having him make political choices so obviously personal that even his deliciously scheming crisis counselor turned campaign manager turned chief of staff Eli Gold takes pause, which we hear in clip two.
Did you just do what I think you did?
I'm simply stating my opinion about the taxation of web commerce.
Peter, you can't be doing that. It'll come back to bite us.
You worry too much, Eli.
What a scuzz. Peter not so subtly threatening Chum Hum and rescinding Diane's Supreme Court nomination in a ham-fisted attempt to woo his wife and get back at Will, his former slash forever rival for Alicia's attentions, is a wonderful way to showcase what a shitbag he is, and another example of how the episode highlights what made The Good Wife great while minimizing what didn't, which leads me to my final Exhibit E. This episode fucking slaps. Hitting the Fan is essentially a heist. Alicia and Carrie have to race against the clock of the various partner and board votes required to fire Alicia and work to hold on to the clients they've been courting in order to maintain their new firm's viability. It's immensely gratifying to see these characters be clever, like the other Carrie warning Carriagos about the impending firings with some well-placed lobby yelling, or magnificent bastard David Lee training his technically not unethical machinations on Alicia. The stakes are high, but the episode never feels self-serious. There's even a break in the action for Alicia and Peter to get some action, as heard in clip three.
This is what they mean by leaning in. Mm-hmm.
You want me to lean in? How's that?
I so deeply respect you.
That aired on a Sunday night on CBS, for gosh sakes. And in a feat that's truly a marvel for the televisual medium, much of what sings about this episode comes from telephone conversations. A solid half of the episode consists of people hissing into their cell phones, but these conversations are so well-paced and well-written and well-acted that the show never feels bogged down by dialogue. Take this near-perfect exchange between Will and Alicia in clip four.
All we told the clients is you were fired and you contact any of them again, and I swear, Alicia, you and Carrie will not have a penny left in the bank.
Oh, go to hell.
No.
You go. Oh, Your daughter called. She needs you to call her school to let her go on a field trip.
Oh, when was this?
About 40 minutes ago.
Oh, okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
I mean, the editing, writing, score, and performances are uniformly stellar. It's no surprise this episode nabbed Josh Charles an Emmy nomination, as he plays Will's hurt and betrayal with an incredulity that hardens into vengeance. Juliana Margulies is every bit his equal. She serves up Alicia absorbing Will's destructive rage, then slipping into efficient steeliness before sobbing in the elevator all in the show's first 15 minutes. It might be hyperbole to call it a tour de force, but it makes for an episode that's an absolute blast to experience. With the evidence entered into the record, I'll offer my closing arguments. The Good Wife is sometimes an outlier in discussions of the most recent golden age of television, and I'd credit its exclusion to the show's stumbles in its later years. The pitfalls of season 6 and 7, the show's less than perfect series finale, and its mishandling of certain relationships may overshadow the memory of what The Good Wife could be when it was at its best. When I die, will I ask God to give me the lowdown on what exactly happened between Juliana Margulies and Archie Punjabi? I am only human, and obviously I will. But for my money, Hitting the Fan belongs in any discussion of the pantheon of television. It's an episode that captures a show paying off years of character and relationship building while also throwing its procedural patterns into a new, exciting, precarious place. Events later in season 5 further destabilized the show's dynamics, but I'd argue Hitting the Fan created a more thrilling narrative prospect, and it's a classic example of what The Good Wife could be. Funny, sexy, relatively legally engaging, with a title card drop no sooner than 14 minutes into the show after a thematically significant elevator ride. There has not been a drama on network television whose highs have hit quite this high since. With that, the defense rests.
Excellent. Alana, you picked this from a list of submissions. Why don't you go first and respond to Jenny's argument?
That was so thorough and like beautiful. rewatching this episode, it really like thrust me back. Like, this episode hurts my feelings in so many ways, especially just because of what happens next with Will and Alicia. It kind of feels like the death knell of what I think was like one of the best will they won't they's out there. But like, the end is so devastating for them. And this, you know, they never really come back from this episode. They never really have time. And that's kind of part of the devastation of, spoiler alert, Will's death. Like, rewatching this episode, it really is so tight, and it really is, like, that tension between them. I was watching it with my roommate who hadn't watched the rest of the show, and he was like, why is this a huge deal that she's leaving? But, like, if you watch the show, you know, like, this is everything to these people.
Yeah.
This is everything to Will specifically. So it's just, it's, I think, one of the great examples of, like, finding a tension between your romance that really feels... like, are they going to come back from this? And you hope that they will, but here they do not. So it hurts my feelings. But I think that is part of what makes the tension of the episode so great.
I'll go next. I love this. We were barely into the episode. We certainly weren't at the title card drop before I was like, oh, this is a really good choice. For us, for a canon submission, because it does, as Jenny said, cover so much of what makes a good episode of The Good Wife. I almost said a good wife episode. She's right. It is like a heist, and going through the steps and how claustrophobic it feels, including, you know, even when the fourth years and Alicia are down in the coffee shop, like at a certain point, I turned to Dave and was like, maybe you should go to another building. But like, that adds to it of how feeling like you're bunkered in with everybody, living through the machinations of what have to happen so fast, and everybody working the phones to try to like get to all of the clients before the other parties do. Yes, Dave.
Maybe like Josh on 30 Rock, he had a Dean and DeLuca savings card, and that's why they had coffee so close to home.
Perhaps. The other thing that's funny about watching this episode, and I also said this to Dave, was that because of how abrupt Josh Charles's death or Will's death on the show was, I sometimes forget that Josh Charles is not dead, like, because of the way they wrote him out of the show is how you would do it if that actor had suddenly died. Like, I sometimes when I see him, like, oh yeah, he is still alive. He's still with us.
He's
anyway.
Fine.
I do think it's crazy that Alicia has to go through Zach to save all her contacts and stuff. It seems like if you had at least 3 weeks to prepare for this, you would have at least like taken, even if you're a weird old lady, like take cell phone photos of your contact pages. But, you know, as Dave said when we were watching this, like people who have had assistance their whole lives, like maybe don't necessarily have the killer instinct.
No compunction to keep up with what they need to do to be self-sufficient.
Yes, they don't think ahead they don't have the killer instinct to like plan ahead in ways that, you know, if they had to leave in a panic, what is the worst case scenario? What would I need to do to prepare for the worst case scenario?
Everybody's got the story about the boss who prints out his email still, so, you know.
Yeah, Jeffrey Katzenberg. We'll get to him.
Yeah, the quippy guy.
I was very happy that this episode featured Alicia in one of her million fucking ugly zippered blazers, because every fucking for how gorgeous.
When sexy's unzippering.
True. But if, like, for how beautiful they dressed Diane all the time, like it was a constant complaint that they had to make Alicia look so bad. Like, why was her wardrobe on this show so terrible?
I'm so used to watching The Good Fight as the norm, but that's weird seeing Diane like not quite being the same character, kind of, or at least not being the focus, and therefore it feels off.
Yeah,
it was kind of interesting.
Anyway, one of my favorite parts, as Jenny also called out, was you know, that Alicia's show of ambition and badassery makes Peter super duper horny, because I feel like that's not something that we see a lot in straight relationships in pop culture, where like a woman demonstrating like mastery and, you know, confidence and stuff in a professional setting, like even when it's happening at home, makes her partner like think that's amazing and not be like, but when are you going to make me dinner, like even now or whenever this aired 5 years ago. So that was cool, and that was an important thing to portray on TV, I think. There's, you know, not enough of that in my opinion. But yeah, this was just so good, and seeing Will like immediately snap into, you know, like take no prisoners vengeance mode, like salt the earth so nothing else will
smite my enemies.
Exactly. To the detriment of like actual cases that he was supposed to be dealing with that day, that he was like not paying adequate attention to, like fully proving the fourth year's points that like there are clients that you are neglecting and that you just swoop in at the last second to take credit for, which is the whole reason that they were getting frustrated in the office and why they wanted to, you know, actually split off and start their own firm in the first place. Like, he was proving that because he was letting his personal shit get in the way of like actually behaving in a professional manner. In addition to which, you know, there were unprofessional reasons underlying it that, you know, between him and Alicia. But I agree with Alana, like they had a great relationship. I mean, I don't know if it was great. It was fun to watch for while it lasted. And it was sad that they never were able to find their way back to each other in a sense. So, yeah, there is definitely a shadow that falls over this episode, but it's a great one to present for the canon, and I loved hearing this case. So thank you, Jenny. Sarah.
I was very happy to revisit this, and like my notes are all like, it's Glinda, it's Eli, because there are some people that I do miss on The Good Fight. But The Good Fight, in my opinion, is the superior show because there's no Alicia. And even watching these again and knowing that like she is the protagonist, she's intended as a flawed protagonist, da da da. But that clip that we heard where he's like, God, you're terrible and you don't even know how terrible you are, is kind of the show about Alicia sometimes, like especially in the latter years, where it's like, this is not, I mean, I think someone knew because the boxy zippered jackets, like I don't think everyone was a huge fan. But it's interesting to watch that now from this distance, and not only have the shadow of what's coming with Will, or, you know, without Will, cast over everything, but, and, you know, seeing Kalinda in her boots, and it's always nice to see her, but it's just seeing the way the show is content to like just let Alicia be
kind of like, just let her be a lawyer. Like, this is a show about lawyers, and they're not always the best, snuggliest people. Mm-hmm. And particularly for a woman in her situation, I always thought that, like, much of what I didn't like about Alicia was not the character, but was a like top note. It's like the whey on top of a cup of yogurt of smugness that comes off of Juliana Margulies.
Yeah.
Not everyone's going to agree with that. My opinion on this is well known, but it's interesting to rewatch this with some distance from the show and yet to be shocked that this episode aired in, I think, 2013. Like, it seems much more recent than that. I'm not sure why. This was an excellent presentation that, despite really liking the show and watching the whole thing and feeling like it was this great underrated drama because it was on a network, but also I felt that this, like, in this era of the show, there were a lot of episodes like this that were extremely tightly edited and tense and just constructed in this heist way with this Soderberghian energy to them that I wasn't sure this would set itself apart. And I was like, well, let's hear what the presentation has to say. And frankly, any presentation that's like, is my first act in heaven going to be to find out what happened between Archie Punjabi and Juliana Margulies? Well, look, I am a tiny, tiny little person, and that may have swayed me. But yes, this is a fantastic episode for all the reasons listed. And yeah, not too many, not too much of the kids. Alicia being everything that she is, and the show letting her do that, and like Old Testament will vengeance mode, and last but never least, Christine Baranski wearing a brooch that has its own Starbucks. Like, that outfit was flawless. Where's Alicia's taste of that apple? Wonder what's going on behind the scenes in wardrobe. Anyway, great presentation, great episode. Thank you for bringing this to us. And yes, I let it roll over on Prime and started watching the next episode, which is a hallmark of canonicality. So yeah, Dave, take us home.
All right. I don't have much new to say, except that I was struck, you know, she was saying it was like a heist movie. I thought it was like a fencing match, you know, thrust and parry, back and forth, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And it made me think, like, there's only a handful of shows that you can identify by just the rhythm of it. And this is one of them. And The West Wing was another one, by just like how the rhythm of not only the dialogue, but just how, you know, part of it's editing, but just how quickly it kind of bounces between things and how fast it does. And I feel like it is a very distinctive signature to this show, and even more so than The West Wing, I think. But The West Wing had that trait too. And, can be annoying sometimes. Swing. A lot of the times I found like a little trying with the you know, the walkabout meetings and stuff like that. You know, fun a couple times. But here I found like this episode was just like fun. Like, that energy is infectious, going back and forth, you know, measure, countermeasure, a tit for tat, keep on going until the end, and that is it. But it's just so tightly edited and fun. You know, what are they going to do next? What's the next screw job? And what's the next counter screw job? It's just like, that's kind of fun. It's sort of like being witness to the stuff that you would talk about the next day that you weren't actually there for as an employee. Uh-huh. Like, did you hear about blah, blah, blah? They did, like, David Lee called the health department on them, I heard. Right? But that's, that's the kind of energy and the sort of voyeurism of this episode that I feel like is makes it so entertaining. Great presentation. Thank you very much, Jenny. So let us put this to the official canon vote. Alana, what say you? Canon worthy?
Yes.
Tara?
I vote yay as well.
Sarah?
Motion seconded. And
all right, that makes it a sweep, so I'll say yes to you. That means The Good Wife Season 5, Episode 5, Hitting the Fan. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Who has our winner?
It's in our episode doc as Jane Lynch. But really, it's me. Jane Lynch is hosting a Weakest Link revival for NBC. I have been saying for years that this should come back. I didn't understand why it shouldn't come back. I'm sure it had something to do with IP wrangling. But they're, you know, pandemic permitting, going to roll it out at the end of this year. And actually, they could probably do this via Zoom. I would sign up for it. I always love The Weakest Link. I'm glad it's back. I think this is a good choice for the host. They said they were going to make some gameplay changes, which I hope don't touch the essence of one of the things I really love about The Weakest Link, which was that Anne Robinson did not care about where you live and your little hobbies. Like, you're just playing and then fucking each other over. So, yeah, hopefully late 2020, Weakest Link revival on NBC. Yay, me.
And loser?
I mean, at this point, it sort of feels like, stop, he's already dead. But yes, it's Quibi, because once again, a new hilariously damning takedown has been published, this time in New York Magazine. We are doing a rare Sunday record, so by the time this comes out, it will have been a week old. But we can't let it pass. Here are some of the tidbits from the New York Magazine story on Quibi. They've spent close to $2 billion already. Their office, apparently absurdly lavish, like even according to producers who went there to pitch and were like, even relative to other, you know, production companies, it's like absurd. Creators get $100,000 to spend per minute of screen time, which I don't know, seems high. Meg Whitman and Jeffrey Katzenberg apparently are bad at sharing power or hate each other, depending on who you ask. They never considered having a tier that was free with ads because the revenue math won't work. I assume it's also because you can't put a mid-roll ad in a Quibi.
In a minute long.
It's six minutes long, you know? Meg Whitman admitted when asked that she basically doesn't watch TV, and when pressed about the last thing that she watched, she said it was Grant on the History Channel, which was about Ulysses S. Grant. Mm. All of Jeffrey Katzenberg's references are at least 30 years old or older, and when Gal Gadot came in to pitch them, he suggested that she could maybe do an updated version of Jane Fonda's workout tape. He's also the one who requires his assistant to print out all of his emails and fold them in half vertically. Okay,
but I mean, honestly, in the right hands, Gal Gadot's workout treated ironically could actually kind of be entertaining.
Sure, if that's not what she wanted to, if she pitched it to him.
Not the way he's envisioning it,
no,
of course.
No,
but,
no.
Yeah. Creep.
Ex-employees compare the mass delusion of, like, this is still going to be a big hit to Fyre Festival. In market research, after Quibi ads that focused on the platform rather than any of the programming ran during the Super Bowl and the Oscars, 70% of respondents thought Quibi was a food delivery service. But they claim they still have enough runway to last through late 2021, and they're launching two new shows a week while other networks and platforms are starting to run out of shows due to the pandemic. And Most Dangerous Game has been renewed, and its creator is prepping a feature film version. But even though that's where the New York story wanted to leave you, I'm like, okay, well, here are the pluses. A few days after the New York story, The Verge reported that Quibi had lost 90% of its early users after their 90-day free trials expired. One presumes that number will go up after the rest of them read that headline and are like, oh shit, I forgot to cancel. Only 72,000 paying subscribers remain as of that Verge story, which means investors paid about $23,000 a piece for them. Again,
wow,
seems high.
I would have fucked off for like $2,000 if they asked. Wow.
Yeah. Well, so Quibi.
Speaking about spending about $72,000 per player, do you know what time it is?
Game time.
Wow. Never been happier to hear it's game time.
All right, this is the 10th game time of the season. The scores are Sarah on the precipice of victory with 4 points.
Oh my.
Tara right behind with 3. And value guest represented by Alana today with 2. Today we are playing It's All Academic from Chris Billig, the Billig of Goods, and Dan Casino.
Oh,
damn you, Casino!
Who earned themselves a extra credit topic for their troubles. They write, of course the EHG panel are all experts on TV.
Of course.
But how much do you know about academic research on television
shows?
Oh,
no.
Oh, Jesus.
In this game, I am going to give you the year and a title of a published academic article about a TV show. You have okay. to name the show it's about.
Okay.
If you can get it with just the title information, mm-hmm. you get 3 points.
Okay.
If you need a hint, I'm going to read you an excerpt from the abstract.
Okay.
And if you need another hint, I'll give you the premiere date of the show in question.
Okay.
So I'm going to let you guess at every stage of this question. So okay. You can guess at the title. If you don't get it, you can guess at the excerpt. If you don't get it, you can guess at the premiere date.
Okay.
But the answer is going to be a TV show.
Okay.
No pressure.
Yeah. We've got 24 questions.
Okay.
A little shorter because I think there's a lot of reading.
Okay.
So I think I might go a little bit long because of that.
Okay.
And we're also going to skip the Grocer's Equalizer Challenge, and we're going to skip steel mills.
Okay.
All right. Because it's by the time you need to use the steel mill, why bother?
Indeed.
So let's throw it to Picky to see who will be starting us off today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. Sarah, Alana, Tara is our order today. Are we ready to play It's All Academic?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. Oh, I will have to say, in their notes, they said they did this game because it might be entertaining, but mostly so that I have to say all this academic jargon. So
Jesus.
Ready for a lot of double takes, triple takes. Here we go.
Mm.
Sarah, from the journal Feminist Media Studies in 2008, the title of the article is Remaking Blank, The Construction of Post-Feminist Hegemony.
Post-Feminist Hegemony.
Yes.
Remaking. Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Here is your excerpt. Blank has been at the center of American popular culture's negotiations over feminism, femininity, and the relationship between the two. This article analyzes the remaking of blank over the past 30 years as a means of considering the remaking of discourses of feminism and femininity in a changing historical context. So,
well, surely that clarifies it.
There's some clues there.
Oh, over the past 30 years, I don't know. The Bachelor.
The premiere dates, first time it was on TV, premiered 1976. Second crack at this, 2011.
Love Boat?
Love Boat. Incorrect. We were looking for Charlie's Angels.
Okay.
All right.
I'm sure you get the date right because I think you said 2008.
2011?
You said the year of the publication was 2008.
Yeah.
How could it have come out in 2008 if it's about Charlie's Angels remake in 2011?
Those are the premiere dates of the show in question. They may not follow the
journal. Okay. All right.
Okay. Alana.
Yes.
From the journal Political Communication from 2006. Your title is Blank Discursive Integration and the Reinvention of Political Journalism.
Oh.
Any idea what that show might be just from the title?
The Newsroom?
Good guess. Not correct. Here is your excerpt. An emerging media environment defined by the forces of technological multiplication, economic consolidation, and discursive integration. A landscape in which real news is becoming increasingly harder to identify or define.
Oh, God. My mind is still on the Newsroom. I don't know. The only other one that came to my mind that I know is incorrect is Silicon Valley. So I'm just going to say that, even though I know it's wrong.
That's not correct. Okay. Your last piece of information is the show in question debuted 1996.
Mm. Oh, God.
Well, it's not what I thought then.
Is Network a show?
Network? Incorrect. Anybody? Take a stab.
No, I thought it was the Colbert Report, but that's not the radio.
Close.
News Radio?
The Daily Show.
Oh.
Daily
oh.
Show. All right, Tara, here's your first.
Yep.
From the Journal of Religion and Popular Culture.
Of course.
2009. The title, By the Gods or Not, Religious Plurality in Blank.
Battlestar Galactica.
That's a decent guess.
Okay.
Good guess.
Your excerpt. As Blank journeys through the ancient world, she interacts with seminal figures, stories, and ideas from various religious and mythological traditions. The TV series constructs the stories in a way that makes provocative suggestions about the truth and usefulness of religion in general.
Xena, Warrior Princess?
Correct.
Hey.
There it is.
Yeah.
Sarah. From the Journal of Psychological Issues in Organizational Culture. Tara, you subscribe to this.
Of course.
2015. Your Tara title.
Founded that.
Bucking the Stereotypes, Blank and Challenges to Traditional Gender Roles.
What was the year again?
2015.
Bucking the Challenges. The Crown.
The Crown. Your excerpt. Combining a traditional girl-centric aesthetic with an all-ages and any-gender approach to their writing and production, the show appeals to a much broader audience than its intended demographic of young girls. But does Blank actually challenge the rigidity of gender roles?
My Little Pony.
Yay!
Oh my God!
Bucking the stereotype.
Oh, I see what they did there.
That is correct. Good for two. Back to Alana. From the Journal of Popular Culture, in 2013, Heroes with a Half-Life, subtitled Blank, an American Repression of Radiophobia After Chernobyl.
Chernobyl?
Yeah.
Can you repeat that? Is that all?
Yes. Journal of Popular Culture, 2013. The title is Heroes with a Half-Life. The subtitle, Blank, an American Repression of Radiophobia After Chernobyl.
Oh, Jesus. I'm going to say Rescue Me, even though I know that's incorrect, but just because it has the word heroes in it.
I like that answer.
All right, here's your excerpt. Dialectic involved in the creation of the main characters was a response to the unconscious cultural injunction to mark Chernobyl as a Soviet crisis. But despite this apparent refusal to co-implicate America's nuclear industry, the stories operate in a furious economy of denial and disavowal of the threat of nuclear power.
And it's from 2013?
The journal article is from 2013, yes.
So it's not about Chernobyl?
The miniseries? No, probably not.
Manhattan?
Oh,
all right,
yeah.
Here is maybe a telling clue with your premiere date. This show premiered in 1987, 1997, 2003, 2012, and 2018. Oh. Five different versions of this property on TV.
I truly have absolutely no idea. I'm going to say 60 minutes, even though
60
that's
minutes.
Incorrect.
No, not 60 minutes, although, you know, we all think that Andy Rooney was a little radioactive. Any guesses?
V?
Is it Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Heroes with a half shell, heroes with a half life, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Correct. Oh my God.
No points for Tara.
Wow.
I was
not making
that
Chernobyl connection.
Tara.
Yes.
Feminist Media Studies makes a return.
Yes.
This article is from 2006.
Mm-hmm.
As Camp as Brie, the politics of camp considered by Blank. Camp with a K, Brie, B-R-E-E.
Desperate Housewives.
That is our first three-pointer
nicely
of the game.
Nicely done.
To Sarah. From the Quarterly Journal of Economics.
Oh, God.
Published 1993. The title, Game Shows and Economic Behavior, Risk-Taking on Blank.
I feel like you could get this.
What is Jeopardy?
Your excerpt. In the bonus round of the game, individuals choose how much to wager on positive expected value gambles with known and varying probabilities and large possible payouts.
Price is Right.
All right, this show had three different series. They premiered 1978, 1986, 2019. Additional information. I love this show.
Okay, it's not what I thought then.
Let's make a deal?
That's what I thought.
I could see that, given the clues there. The show was Card Sharks, the very simple, very dumb game show where you just get a card and then you say whether the next card is going to be higher or lower. Boy, I love that stuff when I was five.
I still love it. I'm sorry that I missed it.
Back to Alana.
Yes.
From the journal Sex Rolls.
Sex Rolls.
Ooh.
From 2004. Blank. Exploring the role of gender. Kind of a tough one to guess, but have a crack at it.
Sex in the City. All
right. Good guess.
Nobody can blame me for that guess.
No.
Your excerpt. James, the male bad trainer, was rated lowest of four trainers on masculine traits, including strength, assertiveness, certainty, and being a leader. Jesse, the female bad trainer, was rated as sexiest and most aggressive.
The Biggest Loser?
Biggest Loser is incorrect.
That's another good guess.
That's what I would guess, too.
This show premiered 1997.
Oh, God.
And I'll give you an additional hint. The show is based on a non-TV show property. Mm. I mean, a non-TV property. Started life elsewhere.
God, I have no idea. Trainers? Mm-hmm. But gender? Could be so many things. I'm completely drawing a blank.
Trainers? 1997 started life not as a TV show, but as a Japanese video game series. We're talking about Pokemon.
Oh,
wow.
I
not
really should. I feel like I just like betrayed my generation.
I thought you were going to get that one because I figured you're Pokemon age appropriate.
So. I was the only one in my class not up on Pokemon.
Oh. Tara.
Yeah.
The Canadian Journal of Anesthesia.
Okay.
From 2019.
Uh-huh.
Blank, bias, and attraction of homemade devices in healthcare. Any idea? Blank, bias, and attraction of homemade devices in healthcare.
The only show I can think of that has an anesthesiologist is Blank. I don't think that's right.
Incorrect. Your excerpt. Immediately available equipment is combined or fashioned in whole or in part to substitute for equipment that is either unavailable or non-functional.
I still... No.
This show had two premiere dates.
Okay.
1985 and 2016.
It sounds like Sarah knows it.
You're going to kick yourself when you hear the answer, though.
I'm definitely mad. I don't know. Extreme Makeover.
All right. Let's just review before Sarah says it. Blank, bias, and attraction of homemade devices in healthcare. Sarah, what do you think it is?
MacGyver!
Of course.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
The Journal of Human Resources, 2005.
Oh, Jesus.
Games and Discrimination Lessons from Blank.
What's the... Sorry, read it again for me, please.
Journal of Human Resources, 2005. Uh-huh. Games and Discrimination Lessons from Blank.
Games. Okay. The Office.
Good guess.
Our results suggest no evidence of discriminatory voting patterns by males against females or by whites against blacks. In contrast, we find that the early rounds of the game, women appear to discriminate against men.
Big Brother.
Incorrect. We have two premiere dates for you. 2001 and 2002. Close together.
Two premiere dates?
I thought I had it, but not if there's two premiere dates.
No. 2002? The Mole?
What if I told you 2001, 2002, and soon 2020 or 2021?
Oh, The Weakest Link.
The Weakest Link.
Oh. I'm right. So sorry, Anne.
This is very full circle.
Back to Alana from the Critical Studies in Media Communication, 2006. Blank, Whiteness in the Harem. I'm going to give you a little hint. Somebody's mentioned this show at some point in the last 20 minutes.
Oh, God. What year was that again?
The journal entry is from 2006.
Okay. It's mentioned it. The Bachelor?
Hey!
Yeah! It's finally good for something.
Nice.
All right, that is Tutara.
Yep.
From the journal Hispania.
Okay.
2013.
Mm-hmm.
Multilingual manipulation and humor in blank.
What year?
2013.
Jane the Virgin.
Understood where you're going there? Your excerpt. Linguistic analysis of the main character's husband. Speech is applied and ideological implications are explored in an attempt to explain how the humor of the program is acceptable to both English and Spanish speakers.
The character's husband who speaks Spanish.
Main character's husband.
Yeah.
You want that year?
No, I remember.
No, you want the next clue is what I was asking.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yes.
This show premiered in 1951.
Oh, I Love Lucy.
Correct for 1 point. And that takes us into our mid-game score break. Tara, let's hear them scores.
All right. Sarah has 2 points. Alana has 3 points. I have 6 points.
All right. Let's get back to it. Yeah, this is a tough one because it's all academic.
Yeah.
It's not like it's all cafeteria lunchtime talk.
It's not all physical education.
Exactly. Sarah. Aslan, I think I'm saying that right. A-Z-T-L-A-N.
Sure.
Aslan, okay. Chicano Studies, 2015. Dark Matters, : blank, suburban crime dramas and Latinidad in the golden age of cable television.
I'm so sorry, but I need to hear that whole title again, please.
Nah. Dark Matters. Blank, suburban crime dramas, and Latinidad in the golden age of cable television. Are you familiar with the name Latinidad?
No.
Okay. Just curious if I was just like late to the party.
The Shield?
Incorrect. Locates the series within a mini genre of cable television that might be called suburban crime dramas, a set of texts that place unassuming white protagonists in contact and usually conflict with non-white denizens of a criminal underworld. So I looked it up. And it's one of those terms that everybody's arguing about still.
Uh-huh.
It's like an academic term from the... It basically, it's kind of like saying Scandinavia, but okay, for Latin American countries, and far it's supposed to be like a group name for a geographical and cultural area without taking identity away from the individual parts that make up that collection.
Got it.
So like, you know, Swedish people are different from Finnish.
Sure, sure.
That kind of thing. That's sort of like what it is.
All right.
Suburban crime dramas. Okay, well, I'm just sort of torn between, like, there's two options. So I will start with Breaking Bad.
All right.
Started with the right one. What was the other one you're guessing?
Weeds.
Okay. Hmm. All right. This is for Alana from the Journal. Excuse me.
Of puberty.
Yeah. Damn, I got to leave that in. This is from the Journal of Popular Culture, 2011. Diagnosing drama, colon, blank, blind casting, and the politics of representation. Diagnosing drama.
Grey's Anatomy?
Dang.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well done.
Everybody's favorite feminist media studies journal, Feminist Media Studies, is back.
Mm-hmm.
From 2018.
Yep.
The title, bit of a long one, Breast Tumors and Bubble Sheets, Examining Persistent Gender Stereotypes About Standardized Testing Throughout Blank.
Breast Tumors and Bubble Sheets. Beverly Hills 90210? Shut up.
Yep.
Wow.
The health scare is not only a plot device meant to instill the importance of breast examination, but a story that conveyed to the girls that they have a particular emotional and corporeal relationship to standardized tests compared with boys.
Mm. It's true. It did. It did do that.
Thanks, Feminist Media Studies. Back to Sarah. Communication Studies, 2009. Creating a Pocket Universe. Shippers, that's in quotes, fan fiction, and blank online. Read that all again for you. Creating a Pocket Universe. Shippers, fan fiction, and blank online.
Buffy.
Good guess. Here's your excerpt. The mostly female shippers hypothesize an unfolding romantic relationship between the series protagonists and thereby oppose male-oriented conventions and commercial imperatives.
I'm sorry, would you mind reading that again?
The mostly female shippers hypothesize an unfolding romantic relationship between the series protagonists and thereby oppose male-oriented conventions and commercial imperatives.
I'd still want to guess Buffy for this, but no. So Sex and the City, why not?
This show debuted 1993.
Models, Inc.
Aw, the dog thinks he's one of the Models, Inc.'s. Incorrect. Anybody?
I was going to guess Doctor Who.
Series protagonist, male and female, equal footing on the show.
Doctor Who was one of the things I thought it was until he said 93.
Yeah, 93, looking, I'm lost.
Fox and Scully on X-Files.
Oh.
Okay.
Alana. Your next one is from the Journal of Popular Film and Television, and it is the one true groaner of a title in this game.
Oh, boy.
So prepare yourself.
Colon, really? A rope of sand.
Yes, basically, but kind of worse. It is from 2010.
Okay.
Blank. Big Brother is not watching you in Bodymore, comma, Murderland.
What?
Let me read that again for you. Blank. Big Brother is not watching you in Bodymore, Murderland. And that's M-U-R-D-A-L-A-N-D. Murderland.
Okay. Interesting.
Bodymore, Murderland.
Bodymore, Murderland.
Got it.
Grim.
Grim, incorrect. Here's your excerpt. Showcases high-tech surveillance technology. But the show is really about the vulnerabilities of surveillance to particular forms of spectacle.
Oh. Surveillance. I don't know. Nikita.
This show debuted 2002.
Oh, Alias?
Sarah knows.
Sarah knows.
Down in the Hole with The Wire.
Down in the Hole. Wire, Baltimore, Maryland is where
Bodymore, Murderland.
Yes. Yes.
Tara.
Yes.
From the Journal of Popular Film and Television, once again. Mm-hmm. Not quite the groaner.
Right.
Not a groaner at all.
Okay.
In fact, it's got a lot of fucking words in it.
Let's get 2002. Yep.
The legacy of blank. Text, textual production, paracinema, and media literacy.
Is this Big Brother?
It is not.
Okay.
Let's all settle down, grab a drink for this excerpt.
Oh, good.
Using Brian Ott's, OTT, theory of textual production, and Ott and Cameron Walters' theory of intertextuality and textual strategies, this article demonstrates blank is a reenactment of paracinematic practice. Blank is a text that teaches paracinema's media literacy, particularly in a world where interactivity is conflated with a truly active audience.
Okay, well, I just broke my wrist doing the jerk-off motion, first of all, so I need medical attention. Clarissa explains it all.
I love that.
If you get this, I don't know, I'm going to give you $100. The show debuted in 1989.
Cop Rock.
No.
MST3K?
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, of course.
God damn it. Picky really fucked me today.
Oh, you knew that? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I should have. I'm sorry.
Well, there's no steel meals. But,
I know, but the glory of getting the $100 question should have been Sarah's. Sarah, but
you
here's your
send
actual
me the $100. You know where
there
I live.
There is a check on its way to you. So.
Oh, that was just for time. Yeah.
Venmo.
Men and Masculinities. 2000 even. Blank, Blue Men, Anality, and Market Masculinity.
Blue Men?
Anality. It's about bums.
What was the date again of this?
2000 even.
2000 even. Well, then this can't be right, but I'm just going to say Arrested Development.
Arrested Development is incorrect.
See, that's what I thought too, but yeah. It's crazy.
This masculinity is shaped by young men's ambivalent resistance and accommodation to the consumer culture. It manifests itself in an expulsive, altogether now,
anality.
Thank you. Unlike the bourgeois character traits described by Freud or the polymorphously sensual scatology that Bakhtin describes to folk culture. Wow.
Oh. I'm suddenly like really glad I didn't go to grad school.
No kidding.
I gotta get published. We're gonna lose tenure.
Oh my god. Old Bakhtin. Oh, the Bakhtin argument. Let's try Jackass.
Oh, good guess.
I do like that guess.
All right, this show started 1997.
Dawson's Creek.
Incorrect. Young Men, Bums, South Park. All right, Alana. Guess what? We're back to Feminist Media Studies. 2010. Learning something from this! ! That's in quotes. The problem of optional ethnicity on blank.
Oh.
Learn something from this. The problem of optional ethnicity on blank.
The Office. I don't know.
Incorrect. Here's your excerpt. Blank judges define model femininity as those contestants whose look is a blank palette or androgynous. Descriptors that signal unmarked whiteness, while non-white women are most often marked as exotic or eliminated for being too ethnic.
America's Next Top Model?
Good for two.
Nice.
Nicely done.
Tara.
Yes.
New Media and Society. New Media and Society. Okay. 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Blank Fandom and the Effective Economics of Crowdfunding Poachers.
Okay. Veronica Mars. Ah!
Nicely done. All right, everybody's got one question left, so let's hear those scores.
Okay. Sarah has 4 points. Alana has 8 points. I have 12 points.
All right. Let's just pretend Tara's not going to win. All right. Sarah. Journal of Sociolinguistics.
Sociolinguistics? Okay.
Sociolinguistics.
Brandon.
2006. The Dark Arts of Good People. How popular culture negotiates spin in blank.
Spin. West Wing.
Hey!
Ooh.
Nicely done. Wow. Alana, your last question is from the Western Journal of Communication. 2014. Queering Street. Homosociality, masculinity, and disability in blank.
Looking?
That's a good guess.
Good guess.
Good guess.
Excerpt. Reading Street's disability story as queer narrative, we emphasize the serious display of contests between homosociality and homoerotics, emasculation and rehabilitation, and athletics and disability.
Oh my god, this sounds like Friday Night Lights, but like, it's, I don't think that it is, but I'm curious about, I kind of want to watch it, but I'm going to say Friday Night Lights even though it's very not true.
I think it is true. Yay!
Yeah.
Wait, the queering of it? I'm so curious. I need to read this.
You can find that in the Western Journal of Communications. If you haven't heard of that publication yet, it's their own fault, apparently.
Subscribe!
That sounds like some fan fiction. I want that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Last question of the game from the Critical Studies in Media Communication, 2008.
Okay.
This title is a big one.
Mm.
May the circle stay unbroken. Blank, the presence of absence and the rhetorical reinforcement of whiteness.
Mm.
That would also make a great title for like a mashed potato recipe.
2008.
2008. May the circle stay unbroken.
It's not Nashville. Nashville Star.
Presenting the closed circle as a visual metaphor, blank turns to the persistence of absence to achieve two rhetorical aims. To perpetuate whiteness as a subjectivity that claims as an exclusive racial position, and to defend whiteness's perceived purity through active exclusion of others. And for some reason, others is capitalized, but it's not lost.
Right.
What I'm saying is don't read anything to others.
No, I got it.
What I'm hearing is this is one hell of a white show.
Yeah. I'm trying to picture what they're describing, but I can't.
Sadly, that does not narrow it down.
Yeah, give me a year, please.
1994.
Friends.
Wow.
I was trying to guide you there, but
I was like, Charmed?
All right, that is regulation. Let's hear the final scores, please.
Sarah finished with 7, Alana finished with 10, and I finished with 13.
Well done.
This game was delivered with enough for 2, so I'm going to save the tiebreaker for a future installment of It's All Academic. So, Tara, congratulations.
Woo.
You won today.
Well done, T-Bone.
Tara.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Dan. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took a few hundred trips down to Hulu's Palm Springs, Hulu, home of the hilarious animated Hulu Awards, before going around the dial with stops at Little Voice, Anne of Green Gables, Cheers, and Close Enough. Jenny won over the jury for Good Wife's Hitting the Fan for the Canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Chris and Dan. Next up, peacocking on Extra Extra Hot Great and of the next EHG Prime Killer Camp. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I deeply respect you.
Sarah D. Bunting.
We all have an Irvine.
And Alana Bennett.
Feminist Media Studies.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
I actually did you a favor, so fuck you.
No, Sarah, fuck you.